This is The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz, filling in this week for Tanzina Vega. We begin with the story of Lillian Calderon.
I am originally from Guatemala. I was brought to the United States at the age of 3, just shy of my 4th birthday. And I've been in Providence, Rhode Island ever since then.
2 years ago, Lillian married Luis, and together they have 2 children.
Luis and I actually met in high school. We were friends at the time. We are high school sweethearts. He says I'm his better half, but I don't know about that. And he and I, we have Natalie and Noah, and Natalie is 5 years old. She's starting kindergarten in September, and Noah is 2, and we cannot be any more prouder to be their parents. They are crazy. They're full of energy. I love every moment I spend with them.
But Lillian is undocumented, and despite what many people may think, citizenship or legal residency is not an automatic perk of getting married. In early 2017, Lillian began the process of seeking legal status through her marriage to Luis. It's a process that can sometimes take years, and it includes lots of paperwork and interviews with the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS.
We got a letter in the mail saying that our I-130 interview was scheduled for January 17th of 2018. We went to our interview at USCIS in Johnston, Rhode Island that morning. Didn't think anything of it. You know, they called Luis in first, and his interview was maybe 5 minutes long. It wasn't long at all. He came out, gave me a hug, told me I was up.
But what began as a pretty standard process quickly took a turn.
When I went into my interview, same thing, my interview was not even a 5-minute interview. What they said to me was, it looks like you are a legitimate marriage. We're going to go ahead and approve your I-130 application, but there are 2 officers here who need to speak to you. So at that moment, I was, well, okay, what do they need to speak to me about? I thought it was part of the process, and it wasn't. It was 2 ICE officers there to detain me.
Lillian was detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials. She was taken to jail and then to an ICE detention center.
I immediately started to cry. I didn't understand how it went from that to now being in the back of a van, being taken away from my family, and not even being able to say goodbye to my husband or my kids. And I was devastated. I had never been in that kind of situation before where, you know, that you're handcuffed. It's a cold feeling. It definitely shakes you to your core. It makes you think, how is this possible? How can we treat people like this? Now you are arresting me and putting me in a van, and all I'm trying to do is go through the system, go through a process that our previous administration had implemented, and now I'm being separated from my family because I'm trying to go through a legal process. It was definitely hard.
The community rallied around Lillian, and with the help of a lawyer, she was released after nearly a month in detention. But the experience is far from over.
Here we were, my husband and I, trying to do everything that we could for our children and ourselves. You know, we were living a quote-unquote a normal life. We were taking our kids to school, doing family fun activities. We had a beautiful house. We were going through the everyday routine, trying to, you know, go through a legal path of citizenship for myself, and just completely blindsided. My family was uprooted. My daughter asked my husband, Dad, why don't I have a mommy anymore? Why did mommy leave us? And to this day, that still hurts because I've always been there for them, and I never even thought that I'd get separated from them.
Lillian Calderon's case is now at the center of a lawsuit brought by the ACLU of Massachusetts. The ACLU alleges the Department of Homeland Security unlawfully targeted Lillian and 4 other immigrants and their American spouses when they tried to seek legal residency. The suit also alleges that Citizenship and Immigration Services coordinated with ICE to schedule and facilitate arrests at USCIS offices. Matthew Siegel is the legal director of the ACLU of Massachusetts and one of the lawyers representing Lillian and the other families in court.
Well, we represent 5 couples, and each of the couples has a U.S. citizen spouse and a spouse who is not a U.S. citizen who is seeking to pursue their green card based on their marriage to the U.S. citizen. And what has happened is that instead of allowing them to follow the path that exists under the law to get their green cards, the government has been targeting our clients for arrest and for detention and removal from the country before they can complete their applications. And our lawsuit is designed to put that to an end.
The practice of seeking legal status through marriage is actually legal. So what's ICE's role here? Why was ICE apparently targeting people going to their interviews with a totally different agency, USCIS?
Well, it's an awful situation, and we now know that it was basically a trap where one U.S. agency, USCIS, Citizenship and Immigration Services, was kind of beckoning our clients forward to come in and have marriage interviews to confirm that their marriages were legitimate as one step in this process towards a green card. And then the government's other hand, ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, was grabbing them before they could complete that process. So the process is available to our clients under the law. So we think that the government is violating the law when it does this. Now, as to why that's happening, it seems pretty clear that what the government, what the Trump administration is after here is not to stop people who are violating the law, but to stop people who are following the law. And the reason why they want that is that they're trying to limit immigration and especially limit immigration by people of color.
Tell us about this collaboration between USCIS and ICE. Is it totally unprecedented? Had you ever seen this before the Trump administration?
Certainly, we've never seen it before. And according to ICE officials who have testified in our case, they point to an executive order by President Trump, which was issued in January 2017, as the reason why these arrests happened. So that is basically an admission that but for President Trump, these arrests never would have happened.
That executive order came just days after he was inaugurated. We reached out to both ICE and USCIS, and you can read their full statements on our website, but this is in part what USCIS told us. When USCIS officers encounter an individual with an outstanding administrative or criminal warrant or removal order, they will notify the appropriate law enforcement agency, but has no role in issuing warrants or removal orders. The originating law enforcement agency has the discretion to decide whether they intend to apprehend the individual or not. So, Matt, what's your response? Do the clients you represent have outstanding warrants or removal orders?
Yes, our clients do have outstanding removal orders, but this process was created for them to pursue their green cards anyway. So the regulations are clear that having a removal order is no bar to this process to pursuing your green card. In fact, it's contemplated by the regulations. So I'm not really sure where that statement's coming from on that point. The other problem with that statement is it doesn't tell the whole truth. It wasn't simply the case that USCIS was sort of letting ICE know that folks were coming in for the interview. USCIS officials, according to documents we obtained in our lawsuit, were also coordinating with ICE to facilitate those arrests, to make them more convenient for the ICE officers, and to even consider things like press attention. They were willing to space out these marriage interviews so that they wouldn't be bunched together because they were concerned, apparently, that if a bunch of people were arrested at once, that would draw negative press attention.
The documents specifically lay out concern about negative publicity. Both agencies want to do this in a way that does not draw negative attention.
Yes, this is laid out in an email where someone is expressing concern that if interviews are scheduled one on top of the other on top of the other, then for one thing, that would make it harder for ICE agents to arrest everybody because they would be overextended. And for another thing, it says it could draw negative press attention.
I just want to also clarify the removal order aspect of this. In Lillian's case, why was there an order for her removal from the country? Why was there an order for her deportation?
Well, Lillian Calderon, our client, was brought here when she was very young by her family. And her family lost their bid to be able to stay in the country lawfully. And when Lillian was a teenager, there was a final order of removal put in place for her. But like a lot of folks, she wasn't removed from the country, didn't leave, and built a life for herself, married a U.S. citizen, built a family. And the regulations that are the focus of this lawsuit say that in that situation, the best thing to do is not necessarily to rip a family apart that's built a life for itself in the United States. The best thing to do is to keep that family together so long as the non-citizen follows certain steps. And that's the law of the land. So That's what Lillian was trying to do when she was arrested at the end of her marriage interview earlier this year.
We should also mention that we reached out to ICE and they sent us a statement saying their collaboration with the Citizenship Agency is, quote, lawful and legitimate in the work we do to uphold our nation's immigration laws. So, Matt, the federal government has requested that the case be thrown out, and I understand that there were court deliberations yesterday. How did they go, and do you have any sense of how the judge may rule here?
Well, nothing is final until it's final, but yesterday the judge did indicate that he's tentatively inclined to reject the government's effort to dismiss the lawsuit, and that would allow us to go forward and seek the things that we want from this lawsuit. What we're trying to do is have a class certified of everyone in New England who's trying to pursue this process of seeking their green cards, and then to get a preliminary injunction in place for that class. And a preliminary injunction would be a court order that would, we hope, prevent people from being targeted for arrest, detention, and removal from the country before they can complete this process of seeking green cards.
And that could potentially mean that Lillian and the others would be able to stay in the country and become citizens eventually?
Well, to become lawful permanent residents, yes. And mm-hmm. And that's what these regulations are designed to do, is to make sure that folks can stay with their families while they follow this path that the government created for them to become lawful permanent residents of this country.
And what happens to Lillian and the others if the judge sides with the federal government?
Well, hopefully we don't have to go down that road. But obviously, in the government's view, they can turn this entire regulation that was issued for the purpose of helping non-citizens and their U.S. citizen spouses into a weapon to be used against them.
Matt Siegel is the legal director of the ACLU of Massachusetts. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ahead of a historic election featuring the nation's first major black female nominee for governor, officials in one Georgia county are considering closing the majority of polling places in a mostly black precinct. A vote on the plan is scheduled for Friday. Critics claim it's a move to suppress black voters. At a meeting last week, an official from Randolph County told community members that is not their intent.
We wanted to hear you. You all have accused us of something we haven't even done. We have not decided. One or two have made their mind up that they know what's in our mind. They do not. We have not decided.
But in a state notorious for minority voter suppression, many county residents are against the plan to close 7 of the county's 9 polling stations. Here's one Randolph County resident speaking at last week's meeting with the elections board. This audio comes from CBS affiliate WRBL.
We might as well get ourselves and get our act together with ACLU and get ready to file a lawsuit. Because there have been decisions that have already been made.
Rose Scott is a journalist and host of WABE's Closer Look. Hi, Rose.
Matt, what's going on?
Oh, well, we're talking about Randolph County. Can you tell us what the stated reasoning behind this proposal is and where the idea came from to close the polls in Randolph County?
Surely I can, Matt, but I want to back up a little bit because I think it's important for folks to know, you know, Randolph County is just about 160 miles southwest of Atlanta, so it's down in the southern part of the state. And like a lot of rural areas, you know, when it comes to polling locations, they may not necessarily be close like it is in an urban area like here in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. So there was a proposal made by an election consultant, a man by the name of Mike Malone, to close 7 of the 9 polling locations. And his reason, as he stated, was that the polling locations were not in compliance with the American Disabilities Act. Mm. And therefore, he had suggested his recommendation was to close 7 of these 9 polling locations. And Randolph County is a very rural county, has about 2 cities in it. But that closing those locations, as the ACLU of Georgia and other organizations see it, would heavily impact African-American voters.
Officials from Randolph County Elections Board said the plan is not intended to suppress black voters, but can you give us a sense of what the demographics are like in Randolph County?
Well, Randolph County is just about 7,700 people, and it is, I won't say overwhelmingly African-American, but the higher percentage there is African-American, but also just not African-Americans. I don't think that people are going to focus on that, but also understand we're talking about a rural population here. We're talking about a rural area. So whether you're African American or white or what have you, I think the issue is that closing these polling locations, closing seven of these nine polling locations is problematic for anyone. But because this county is primarily African American, I believe that's why the ACLU of Georgia and other organizations are concerned.
And the concern is that it would take quite a long time for people to drive to a new polling location. And also, I imagine they might not even know that their polling location that they're accustomed to going to has been closed. Are those the issues in terms of impacting the ability of people to vote?
In my conversations with Andrea Young, daughter of civil rights icon Andy Young, who is the executive director of the ACLU of Georgia, made a very good point, I think, in that when you talk about rural communities like this one in Randolph County, everyone doesn't have access to a vehicle. And she also said that closing these locations would mean for some people driving 15 miles or more, or trying to get 15 miles or more to the next polling location, and that is problematic.
Now, the backdrop to all of this is the governor's race, and you have Democrat Stacey Abrams, who would be the first female African-American governor in the country ever. And then you have Republican Brian Kemp, who's the Secretary of State, who recommended the elections consultant who came up with this proposal. Can you give us the dynamics of the gubernatorial race that's the backdrop for all of this?
Well, I think it's important to note that according to Secretary of State Brian Kemp and his office, they did not recommend Mike Malone per se.
Okay.
There was an official from Secretary of State's office, from Brian Kemp's office, who recommended that they find somebody. We had a message from Secretary Kemp's office saying that he in no way had any authorization over this matter. However, records do show that Mike Malone did make a small contribution to Brian Kemp's campaign.
And what is Democrat Stacey Abrams saying about this whole controversy?
Well, Stacey Abrams for a long time has been an advocate of trying to prevent voter suppression. I mean, it's something that she was doing when she was a House Minority Leader here in the Georgia legislature. And it's something that a lot of, you know, civil rights organizations have been fighting for a long time. As you know, there were calls for Secretary of State Brian Kemp to step down while he was running for office. He found that not to be helpful or productive, and so he has remained in his position.
Does Randolph County have a particular history with voter suppression?
I can't speak to that, Matt. What I can speak to is that if you look up voter suppression in the South, the history of it is clearly there. I don't think anyone would deny that. And then since you've had what some call the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, when situations like this arise, you have a lot of civil rights organizations that are saying, look, this is something that's been happening. This happened, you know, decades ago. And by their admission, they're still fighting the same fight.
You're the host of Closer Look in on WABE in Atlanta. What are your listeners saying about this whole controversy? What are you hearing from them?
Well, what I'm hearing from listeners through emails and social media is that they are concerned that all of this is happening right before a very, very big election taking place in November. It could be historic for the state of Georgia. So anytime there's any problems or anytime there's something that doesn't look right as relates to voting, and particularly in a state like Georgia that has a history of voter suppression, I think a lot of people are concerned.
Rose Scott is a journalist and the host of WABE's Closer Look. Rose, thank you for covering this issue and for giving us your insights.
Thank you, Matt, for having me.
Students in Florida head back to school this week, and kids like middle schooler Jasmine of Miami-Dade are noticing their campuses look and feel a little different than they did before summer break.
They're adding fences. The security guards got new uniforms, and then the police were in the front of our school.
In March, a month after a gunman killed 17 people at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, Florida passed a $400 million school safety bill, which includes money for mental health assistance, armed security personnel, and other surveillance technology. But it's not necessarily enough to eliminate all the concerns that parents have this school year. Nicole Crooks is Jasmine's mom. She told me about her daughter's first day at school.
Well, she actually had a good day. it started off for me kind of bumpy. There were a couple of things that she noticed that were a bit different in terms of their freedom and flexibility and going outside, in terms of, it sounded like even recess. There were some heightened security precautions regarding that, and that they were in the process of building more fences and gates. And it was so funny because when I pulled up to drop her off at school today, another fence or gate had been erected.
How do you feel about that?
Honestly, it's kind of disconcerting for me as a parent. When I first heard about it, my initial thought was, oh my gosh, we're going to turn into something that feels like a police state. And to be honest with you, that's kind of exactly how it's feeling, and where there is this underlying feeling of fear. They don't have as many security guards, or she didn't notice as many security guards. But the uniform that I saw, the new uniform last year, it was like the kids' uniform, but it was security. You know, it was like really open. And now it looks kind of militaristic. And then you see the presence of the police around the school as you drive up. There are lots of police. And now the fences are going up. And it was just so interesting because she talked about it and how that was of concern to her. And then driving up, and she was like, Mom, that's my shortcut. And the fence was there taking away her shortcut. Her biggest thing was it took away the shortcut. My biggest concern was, oh my gosh, it looks like jail.
Is that why you said the day yesterday started off bumpy for you? Because you were seeing this place that didn't look all that much like school anymore to you?
Well, the reason it started off bumpy for me was because we had resolved that Jasmine was going to be homeschooled this year. Not necessarily because of the security, but I felt more at peace because everything was happening with the security and the guns and all of this and all of that. But more so because we have dealt with bullying, and it just reached ahead last year. And so the homeschooling for me kind of gave me peace of mind. Because really and truly, what I learned through that whole situation is that the school really is not equipped to deal with bullying. And so when we look at something like a Parkland, when we look at something where children are having all of these meltdowns in schools and the schools are not equipped, the reality is that we can build the bigger fences, we can have more police officers, but if the kids' needs are not being addressed effectively, we're still going to have the same issues. And so as a parent, I would rather invest the $10 million. I heard that just out of nowhere, they found the $10 million for all of these changes. And so if we're going to invest $10 million, like, can we invest in mental health? Can we invest in supporting our kids? Like, can we invest in training our teachers and administration on what bullying is,
right,
and what it looks like? Because we're just putting a Band-Aid on like a gushing problem.
Thank you, Nicole. I hope Jasmine has a wonderful year at school this year. And I hope you and her feel very safe regardless.
Thank you so much.
Nicole Crooks is the parent of a 12-year-old in the Miami-Dade County School District.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your shortlist of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
All right, the WNBA playoffs start tonight. So we turn again to Lindsay Gibbs, sports reporter at Think Progress and the co-host of the feminist sports podcast, Burn It All Down. She says one of the most exciting matchups in the playoffs is tonight.
The Los Angeles Sparks and the Minnesota Lynx, the two teams who played in the finals the last 2 years, will face off in the first round in one game winner-takes-all series.
Whoa.
So you definitely will want to tune into that. The way the WNBA playoffs are set up, the first round is a single elimination, two games. Second round is single elimination, two games. And the top two seeds get a bye to the semifinals. So you'll have the Seattle Storm and the Atlanta Dream waiting for their opponents.
So the Las Vegas Aces finished their inaugural season just one spot out of the playoffs, but they forfeited this crucial game a few weeks ago because of a series of plane delays, and it meant that they were traveling for 26 hours straight, landing only a few hours ahead of their game. This was the first time a team in the league had forfeited a game. What was the result of all this? What was the fallout?
Yeah, well, it was quite a dramatic thing. As you mentioned, they only got to Washington, D.C., where they were supposed to play against the Washington Mystics, about 4 hours before tip-off. The league was able to postpone the start of the game 1 hour, but ultimately the Aces players said, "We have been in the airport all night. We have been traveling on flights. We have not slept. We have not, eaten properly. And we're afraid that if we play this game, that we're at the risk of injury." And that's a very legitimate concern that they had. So the league ended up saying that they forfeited the game. So I think what ended up happening was this has really galvanized the players and brought this issue into the light. I've had a lot of WNBA players from multiple teams tell me versions of, they kind of took one for the team here. They drew attention by forfeiting this game to a larger issue that all WNBA players are incredibly concerned about, and they're hopeful that this will give them some more leverage in their upcoming contract negotiations.
What's that issue? Is it the amount of travel, the workload, the way they do travel? What is the issue?
Yeah, I think all of the above. So they just travel on regular flights like you and me back in coach.
Wow.
And so that doesn't give them much flexibility.
And they're taller than you and me, I imagine.
Just slightly. I don't know your height, but I'm assuming it's not 6'8".
Right.
So so that's incredibly grueling. And they often change time zones and don't have a day off in between their travel and the game like it is required in the NBA. Mm. They're just asked to put their bodies through so much. And you have to remember when the WNBA, most players are playing this four-month WNBA season for much less money than they actually earn overseas during the more traditional basketball season. So if they injure themselves during the WNBA season, that can often keep them from being able to sign a contract overseas where they earn the bulk of their money.
You referenced work conditions and then pay, and later this fall, the league is facing this big moment over a collective bargaining agreement, and we've seen female athletes in soccer and hockey fight for higher wages. Is this the top issue, the wages of these WNBA players?
Wages and travel are absolutely the top two issues right now, and it's pretty exciting. So what's happening is they have to decide by October 31st if they are going to opt out of their current collective bargaining agreement. Now, even if they opt out on October 31st, this current collective bargaining agreement is still good through the 2019 season. However, they just have to decide now. And what you're hearing from players is that there has never been momentum like this in the league. And I think it's due to what we've seen in other sports, as you mentioned, the U.S. women's national team in hockey and in soccer fighting for better pay and better accommodations. And also how you've seen the league really bind together when it comes to speaking out about issues of race.
Yeah.
A few years ago, they had a big Black Lives Matter movement where they really took on the league together when the league tried to fine them for wearing Black Lives Matter t-shirts. And that solidarity has just simply grown over the years.
Do you have any pick for who's going to win the championship this year as we move toward the playoffs?
Oh, gosh, it's so hard. The Storm look good, but I think the Washington Mystics, keep an eye on them. It might be a little home field bias here since they're the team I cover the most. But Elena Deladon is hard to count out.
Got it. Lindsay Gibbs is a sports reporter at Think Progress and the co-host of the feminist sports podcast, Burn It All Down. Thanks so much, Lindsay.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Matt Katz here, back with you on The Takeaway. Today, prisoners in at least 17 states across the country go on strike.
Prisoners will be refusing to go into their job assignments. They're also going to be doing sit-ins. Another way that they'll be striking is through boycotts, so refusing to spend money in the prison.
Amani Sawari is one of the organizers on the outside of the national prisoner strike. where prisoners will refuse to work and in some cases refuse to eat in response to a deadly prison riot this past April at Lee Correctional Institution in South Carolina.
Seven inmates are dead and 17 others are injured. One inmate claims the bodies were literally stacked on top of each other.
17 more prisoners need medical attention right now.
It took officers more than 7 hours to contain the fight. A coroner says most inmates died after being stabbed with homemade knives or slashed.
It was the deadliest prison riot in 25 years. Isaac Bailey is a journalist and professor, and two of his brothers did time at Lee Correctional. One of them was there during the deadly riot, and Bailey says his brother saw this coming from a mile away.
One of the sort of like major things that he saw had was this major cut back in staffing that sort of actually gave prisoners this kind of incentive. To actually join gangs for their sort of like personal protection. They actually knew that guards would not be there.
Because of the low staff numbers, inmates were forced to stay in their cells for most of the day.
Even when it came to things actually being able to take a shower, for instance, that too was like actually cut way back. Once a week sometimes, and also having to try to ward off things like rats and roaches like in your cells.
We reached out to South Carolina's corrections department. They didn't immediately return our request for comment. And since the riot, Bailey says he's talked to prisoners there who say nothing much has changed.
They have actually felt that things have actually gotten worse, not better. One of the sort of like major things that has happened since then is that they have been subject even more sort of lockdowns. They actually feel as though that sort of like many people simply don't care about their fates.
Now, inmates and advocates on the outside are calling for a nearly three-week-long nationwide strike, beginning today and running until the anniversary of the 1971 Attica prison uprising on September 9th. The strike was announced by Jailhouse Lawyers Speak, a group of incarcerated people advocating for prisoner rights in South Carolina. Amani Sawari is helping efforts from the outside, and she says this strike is about more than wages and clean cells.
There are 10 demands that prisoners have released: an immediate end to prison slavery, which relates to the 13th Amendment. Prisoners want to see that amendment abolished. A lot of people think of the 13th Amendment as the abolition of slavery, when really it wrote slavery into the Constitution.
As many of you might remember from your U.S. history classes, the 13th Amendment reads, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction, except as a punishment for crime." That's what Amani is talking about here.
It gave slavery a legal place to be used in our country. And there's no such thing as an abolition of something that has an exception clause. You can't say this is done except in the case of, and that's exactly what the 13th Amendment says. So prisoners want to see that amendment abolished. And then when that amendment is abolished, the work that they do, they can be paid a prevailing wage. Another one is gang enhancement laws. And in prison, being in a gang is really one of the only sources of protection. And these types of enhancements we want to see an end to. We don't want to see prisoners divided by the gang that they're in. Another demand that's really big is prisoners want the right to vote. They want to see formerly incarcerated and currently incarcerated individuals have that right.
How do you organize a strike like this when it involves prisoners who have limited access to the internet, phones? How do you let them know that this is happening, and how do you mobilize them for this action?
So communication can be really slow. And like you said, communication is very limited. Prisoners have JPay, which is a messaging online email system that they have to pay for. This is probably like the least secure way to speak to a prisoner, so we don't use that. But they also have mail, and that's something that I use a lot. And then some prisoners have their own individual cell phones that they've purchased from prison guards who smuggle them in for money. And so Jailhouse Lawyers actually has their own phone. They tweet. You can go to Slavery Prison on Twitter. That's his handle if you want to see his tweets. And he actually contacted me through there to ask me to host a strike on my website.
I'd like to return to the work that inmates are doing in prison. We've seen this year that inmates are helping fight fires in California, and they make all kinds of products. Here in New York, they make hand soap dispensers for many city and state-owned buildings. What do we know about the wages that these prisoners earn and the working conditions for some of the jobs that they're doing?
One really big thing that people need to know is that prisoners, especially in states like Michigan, but in most states, they're required to work. They're required to have a job. So if you go to prison, you have to sign up and have a work assignment. And in a lot of cases, you can't choose what that work assignment is. For example, I have a friend in Michigan who signed up to work for the dog program, which is just training dogs for the deaf and the hard of hearing people. He wanted to do that, but there was no space in the program, so he was forced to work in the kitchen 8 hours a day for 10 cents an hour for 3 months, which was absolutely miserable for him. And if he would have refused to take that job assignment, he would have been moved from a level two prisoner to a level five, in which he would have had to stay in his cell for 23 hours a day. So really people say, oh, well, prisoners like to work. They want to do something with their time, but they don't have much of a choice. And when you're in prison and you don't have a lot of family support financially, and a lot of these prisoners don't, then you're kind of forced to do something. And then out of what you're forced to do, you might not have a lot of choices.
There's a lot of ambitious demands in this manifesto, and this strike is intended to resolve many of these issues that you've been talking about. How will you be able to measure success out of this strike?
First, I really do not think that the demands are ambitious at all. I think that they're quite reasonable. It's about time to give prisoners what they need to rehabilitate themselves. They need resources, access to classes, a prevailing wage. So what would measure success is seeing politicians come to the forefront and say, these demands are absolutely necessary. They're not ambitious. We need to stand with them. We all know that picking at something that's already broken, that's putting tape on something that's already just destroyed, isn't going to work. So we need to see something ambitious. We need to see something that's just completely out of the ordinary, because we need a change that's going to be transformative.
Imani Sawari is a writer and advocate for Jailhouse Lawyers on the Outside. Thank you so much, Imani. I appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Have you ever been incarcerated? What were the conditions like?
My name is Alex. I watched an inmate get beat after he was handcuffed and then pepper sprayed. I spent 8 months without having to go outside rec, and the sociopaths are the guards, and the criminals are watching the criminals.
My name is Angel. I'm calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. As a former inmate, I would say that it definitely is bad. The food is barely even edible and people would rather starve. And if you don't have money for commissary, high sodium noodles, then you just don't eat.
If you were incarcerated, or if you know someone who was or is still in prison, tell us what the conditions were like. What do you think about the strike and their demands? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for being with us. Eid Mubarak to all who celebrate. I'm Matt Katz, filling in for Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway.